Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf. Yay, and we want to say Happy New Year to everyone.
Happy New Year. Well, I guess you've had your eye opener this morning.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm ready to go, Tony.
Coffee?
No coffee.
Coffee with medicine?
No, definitely not.
Just medicine?
No, none. Just.
Okay.
Just ready to go.
Just natural.
To enjoy this brand new year.
For some people, 2016, they're happy to wrap it up and put it in a box. But there's some good things to remember, too. Good things to eat and drink, or that we ate and that we drank.
Yeah, for sure. Thankfully for that.
Yeah, absolutely
grateful
for that.
It is often time around the table where things can be resolved and where we can help each other through any sort of difficult issues, as well as hopefully just have pure enjoyment and escape things sometimes.
Well, all the best things in life pretty much happen at the dinner table,
right? I agree.
So we're going to spend a little bit of time going through a couple of our favorite things in 2016 that we ate or drank. And if there are any regrets, things you did not eat or drink. And then we're going to jump through a segment in the middle with Robert Britton, who is a very busy winemaker in Oregon, really talented young guy. And then, of course, the Chef's Challenge, I guess. The program is the first of 2017, so it'll have to be the first Chef's Challenge of 2017. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
So what's on your list? The good stuff.
Well, I was fortunate enough to get to go to France in July this year, which was a time that I don't usually go in July. I prefer to travel when it's truffle season in January or when it's a little bit cooler outside. Just I feel more comfortable to travel at that time of the year. And so to be there in July was really, really a lot of fun. And it was nice to see the food from that season and to get to see what was in the markets. And one of my favorite aspects of this trip, which was centered around going to the southern part of France and the southern Rhone Valley to an area that you and I have talked about because we have traveled there for many years with staff, to Mondragon or to La Beaugraffière, and Guy Julien is the chef there. And let's see, Tony, haven't we been eating his food for probably about 20 years now?
Yeah, and I definitely did not get to eating his food in 2016.
I got to eat there 5 nights in a row, which really was
okay. That may be
kind
of
really awesome.
That may be a bit of a record.
Yeah, that was pretty incredible. I traveled.
Nothing like variety to the diet.
I traveled with two Catholic priests, and these are guys that love food and wine, and they were amazing to travel with. And they actually stayed at La Beaugraffière, and the family that owns the restaurant has a few rooms right there where the restaurant is. And you know, think about Mondragon being a town of how many people do you think live there? 150?
112?
Yeah, not too many.
My guess is it's more like 400 or
you
500.
You think so? Okay. So 500 people live in this town.
They have a soccer field.
Yeah, they do. They have their priorities, you know, in line, of course. Great truffles, great wine, and a beautiful,
and
beautiful farming area. Yeah, and a soccer team. So one of the cool things about the guys staying there was that I would go to get them. I stayed at basically where the popes were seated. When the popes were seated in Avignon in the, late 1200s, early 1300s, they had their judicial palace in very close to where Beaugraffière is. I can get there in about 18 minutes on the back roads. It probably should take you about 25, 30.
You know that's where they used to torture people, right?
No, don't say that. But
I'm sure they did nice things, too.
Oh, geez. But it's an old chateau, and it looks over the southern Rhone Valley. It looks over the directly to Mont Ventoux, which is one of the highest peaks in that region. And I always thought it was snow-capped, and it was not until this trip that I realized that, because I was doing research, especially to talk to the guys, because they had not been there, it's chalk at the top of the mountain, and that's what you see that's white. Boy, that was a big disappointment for me.
It's much more fun to think it's snow, right?
Yeah, I prefer to continue my snow fantasy at the top of Mont Ventoux.
Hey, I'm curious. Back to that palace, which is a wonderful
place to stay. I'm not saying
what
it's called either. No way.
It's a wonderful place to stay.
Oh, yeah.
And very cool to be around there. But, I mean, that judicial palace only means one thing. And
well,
that's where justice comes down.
Well, their prison is right on top of the building, which is pretty cool to see because you can actually, it's attached to one of the rooms, and it's fun to go up into that little old prison.
I'm confident that there were two different prisons in that building.
Oh, God.
You should ask the priests, who are wonderful guys. to do a little research for you on the history of that particular okay. property.
Well, and that's a really cool little town, too, where the chateau is. And just a super special place. What I was getting at with the guys staying at Beau Gravière, I would go to get them in the morning, and then we would go do whatever our day trip for the day was. And they would have breakfast out on the patio, which, God love them, you know, how nice is that? You know, Madame comes out with great coffee and pastry, bread, butter, you know, butter to die for, basically. And I'd walk up and they're just like smiling, happy as they can be. Mm-hmm. And here come the chanterelles or the girolle. And here come the, you know, gigantic boxes with whole animals in them and, you know, birds coming in, squab coming in.
Yeah,
it was so cool. I mean, as many times as I've been there, I've never gotten to see it in the morning when the farmers are bringing their product in. And for me, that was, oh my gosh, it was just absolutely amazing. And I love Guy. He's really an amazing chef. He pretty well works from scratch. He doesn't do a lot of prep ahead of time. It's kind of amazing to think that you're sitting down and something is being made pretty much, and I don't mean, you know, maybe even a soup almost, you know, mm-hmm. being literally made as you order it. That's hard. That's really amazing.
Yeah. It's also
and I think
not
that
fast.
Has to
I
do,
mean, that's something
no.
that would never happen in the States.
Well, of course not. And people are more leisurely in their dining, and they respect a table in France. That's one of the reasons why I'm so in love with the French culture is there's just so much respect for food and wine and the process and farming and everything that is attached. That is the most important thing, respect for the product. From the time it comes in the back door until it hits the guest. So getting back to best meal of 2016, and I'm sorry for that
best dishes
runoff, but yeah. I think it's important what I just said. I had a dish there that was a girolle tart, and I had it every single night because I could not have it, which is ridiculous. I always try new
sense
things.
You had sense enough, like when something is excellent and something is fleeting, like girolles, and you don't have them for so long. And they only come from so many places in France, and you can get them perfect quality. Why would you not eat them while you can? Because the next 5 years, you're not going to be in that situation.
Exactly. And, yeah, it was five nights,
so
but
it's reasonable to have 5 years
back.
Worth of girolles.
Thank you.
In 5 days.
So the tart, when I went back and talked to Chef about how he made it, and he's very generous with every bit of his knowledge and has taught me a lot of things over the years. When I went back to talk to him before I left the first night, actually it was the second night because I didn't want to bother him the first night. But when I had it the second time, I'm like, I just have to find out what's in this dough. And he said that it was a sablé dough, which sablé means sand in French. And it's a very simple dough that's very crumbly in texture.
It's like a savory cookie dough.
Exactly, yeah. Savory cookie dough. And he puts Reggiano in it. And that, I'm like, oh, God, that's it. That's what makes it so well. Of course, their butter also makes it phenomenally perfect. And, of course, their flour is going to be different from ours and, you know, everything. But it is the idea of lots of butter, a little bit of egg, the flour, salt, but adding that Reggiano to that dough and then rolling it out, working it gently. I barely process it in the mixer when I mean, it may be the paddles on for like 10 seconds, and then I pull it together by hand from there and barely knead it and then let it rest for some time before I roll it out. And you roll it out, cut a circle out. And then I said, but Chef, there's some, you know, there's like garlic in here. You know, he was, oh, well, I put snail butter on there. I'm like, oh, my God. He's such a genius. I mean, it just so these gorgeous, tiny, perfect, beautiful girolle cooked perfectly on top of this amazing tart dough that's crispy and crumbly and melting in your mouth and tastes like Reggiano and butter. And then, of course, it's summertime, but he has gorgeous summer truffles that you just could die for. They're so amazing. And summer truffles are not the brilliant truffle. It's a black winter truffle that is so amazing. And for his summer truffles to be so great, and he is known for his work with truffles, and if anybody's going to have them, he's going to have many slices of these gorgeous summer truffles on top of this tart and to have that butter. And what he referred to as snail butter is, of course, something that has garlic and, you know, a little bit of
lots of parsley,
parsley and butter predominantly. Might have had wine or acid or something, but
probably verjus.
So that was on top, and then more Reggiano, and then more truffle on the plate and truffle oil on the plate. I'm just like, oh, my gosh. It was brilliant. So that absolutely will stand in my mind not only for this year but for the rest of my life. And I immediately came back and made it. And I've been making it on and off, but now that we can't get chanterelles, I have stopped making it. And I'll bring it back next summer because it is a gorgeous dish, and I'm very thankful that I got to have it. and I managed to drink it, eat it with a lot of really good wine.
That sounds like you drank it.
There was a lot of, I did drink it. There was a lot of Pago. I had to drive, so there wasn't that much drinking, but there was some good drinking since there was no quantity to the drinking. And we had some Pago with that and a couple of nights, and we had Bocastel and Clos de Pape and the ladies. I can't think of their name right now.
Marcou.
The two sisters. Marcou.
Yeah, sure.
Oh my gosh. Marcou. I mean, and we were visiting with Clos de Pape on that trip with the owner, and we also met with the sister from Marcou. So we were all very determined to get to taste as much of their wine as we could while we were there.
That's a good plan.
Yeah, it was a very good plan.
One of the lessons of experience is drinking quality as opposed to quantity.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yes. And savor every moment of it.
So it's funny. So you had one seminal experience. I have just a list, mostly of products that a bunch of great things got done with.
Well, good. Okay. That's a different approach.
We had this 1 week of white nectarines in the summer that were just...
I love nectarines. But
they were magically good.
Good.
That in every year, you ask me, well, what happened with tomatoes in 2004 or something, and I'll tell you that it's kind of silly. It's a little bit like vintages for everything else, but I think about produce a lot of times that same way. And the two things this year that really stunned me, well, three. One, the tart cherries were great. They were short. They were great.
Yeah, they were.
I have a mountain of them preserved in my house in a bunch of different ways. And even some done as cocktail cherries.
That's nice.
Preserved in Luxardo and with a little star anise. And yeah, they're fantastically good. But the white nectarines, and there's some preserves that are excellent from it, but oh my gosh.
Just to eat
one. They were just incredibly good.
Yeah, all you had to really do was just eat it.
for a few minutes this summer, one of the restaurants was serving foie gras torchon, and we just put like three nice fat slices of the white nectarines on the plate.
Gorgeous.
And having that with the crunchy salt and a little toast and a glass of sauterne, it was a very spectacular moment. And the next harvest from the same orchard, not the same. Not the same.
I'm trying to remember what I did with the white peaches, and I think we served it with the magre. White nectarines.
We had the 2 week period. They were amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just
yeah, things
really
were a little fleeting this summer because we did not have a good stone fruit summer.
No. All that Rainy May delivered a fantastically long and high-quality
asparagus season. Yeah. I couldn't believe it when you guys kept bringing it to us. I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is amazing. And it tastes really good.
7 weeks of great asparagus.
Yeah, that was pretty brilliant. That was exciting.
And then there's a million ways that it got used. There was one with a little bit of just simply with spaghetti alla chitarra and very good olive oil and a whole lot of fresh herbs, a lot of tarragon.
That's nice.
And Reggiano, that I think was my favorite of the year. But
I'll never forget having that wild asparagus in Italy at the family's house in Umbria.
With the little tomato.
The wild asparagus, and they're so thin and long and so different, but yes.
Yeah, very good. And then two proteins I think about. One, that spectacular duck that we started to get from Jagiellowitz Farm that is not as strong as Magre, and the fat that you render from those duck breasts is so clean, you just want it for pastry. I mean, that's nonstop, you want it for pastry. And the other is finding the Uruguayan beef.
That beef is amazing.
The great Uruguayan beef with the incredible flavor that's so much more healthful and leaner and it is
different from our beef, though. So
there's just not as much flavor in other beef as this.
Yeah, it's
you keep looking for more flavor presence, and I kept looking for more flavor presence in beef, and this is
a different texture, but it's really, really, really good. Love the Uruguayan beef.
Coming back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, a few more highlights of 2016, then an interview with Robert Britton and a chef's challenge, Chef Wolf.
Okay.
All of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And about that beef from Uruguay.
Yes. Can we have some right now, please? Yeah. So what cuts have you been looking at with that?
We've tried a lot of stuff. We've tried that. We've used strips. I mean, we use the classic, the beef rib steak. One of the things with that beef that's so different is that the cattle are 800, 900 pounds. Most U.S. cattle are 1,500 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And the beef on the Pampas live about 2 years on live grass.
Okay.
And here, it's 15 months tops. And they get to 1,500 pounds typically versus the 800 to 900 that you see down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of the life that they live and the diet that they have, their fat is a lot. There's much less fat, for sure, and it's a lot healthier.
Do you know what the cattle breed is?
It's an English breed. I'm completely spaced out about the name. Huh. It's an English breed that has been crossed with some other English breed. It's a shorthorn. It's a very short.
Okay.
It's the opposite of a longhorn, both in size and in...
horn size.
The size of its horn, yeah.
Okay.
Horns.
What else anyway. Have you liked from 2016, product-wise? Or was that your last product?
Well, no, I mean, that's... We developed a totally different chimichurri for that.
Yeah, I was surprised by that actually. That I'm so used to Marcello's
that I love,
chimichurri.
Love.
Yeah, it's fun to have the different types of chimichurri.
You know, that's one of the things, like having tasted a bunch of stuff and then researching. So we tried a bunch of different combinations to get the one we thought was most exciting with the meat, and that's mm-hmm. what you want, right? So
And
recipe will never be shared now.
And when I reference Marcello, the restaurant was named after my chef, Marcello. And he made his chimmy with tomatoes, which is not traditional. So, you know, and I never knew that. I just assumed because he was from Argentina, you know, and he was my chef and I would defend my chef to the death, basically. I will never forget when we had to relocate the restaurant from Charleston to Knoxville, Tennessee after the hurricane in 1989. I was the chef, and Marcello had stepped out. He wanted to be the restaurateur, and one of the guests complained that there were tomatoes in the chimichurri, and I said, well, I make it exactly the way chef makes it. You know, chef knows what he's doing. He's from Argentina, and Marcello came up to me and he said, well, actually,
it's supposed
to be green, all green. I'm like, oh, yeah. Chef. But anyway, it was very good. No matter what, it was really, really good. And what I loved about his was he put raspberry vinegar in his, which really gave it a pretty perfume. And that was very indicative of the times as well. I mean, you're talking 1989, and raspberry vinegar was pretty unusual in 1989. That was a new product.
But it was the thing. It was definitely a thing.
For sure. For sure. And that chimichurri had fresh tomato, hand-chopped tomato, garlic, shallot, finely chopped, and a lot of it. And he did always say it was supposed to be more green than red. I remember that from the first time I made it, when he taught me how to make it. And I remember making it because we were in Charleston, and we made it and put it in a crab cup, a plastic crab cup that the pound of crab mm-hmm. made to come in. And I'm like, well, that's kind of weird. But anyway, I'll never forget that. Then it has a basil, a tiny bit of thyme, and a whole lot of Italian flatleaf parsley. And he would put extra virgin olive oil in, a touch of raspberry vinegar, and salt. It had no pepper, and it had no peppers in it, and it had no dried herbs in it. It was all fresh, which, again, is very unusual because, I mean, you and I have both been to Argentina, and we know what goes on the table, which looks like, you know, dried oregano and, you know, dried basil,
yeah,
maybe, and
the dried oregano
a little
is a
oil.
Little bit of cheating. I mean, that's...
there are many, many versions of chimichurri in Argentina.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Period. End of story. It's like the way they make their empanadas. It's down to the family. I mean, not only down to the town or the village or the region, it's down to each family. They all make their, you know, they all have their
Everyone
way
has a twist.
Of making an empanada.
Everyone has a twist. Do you have any wine on your list of the best things that you tasted in 2016?
Well, I would have to say some of the wines that we drank. We drank some older Bocas del and Clos de Pape and, as I said, Marcou and Pego on that trip. And it was, you know, that's also a great thing about going to his restaurant is his cellars, you know, has such depth to it from the region. And that is my favorite, if I have to say a favorite wine growing region, I would say that is it. And to be able to have some of the older wines. And at work, we've been concentrating. I think the other fun thing is that we've been concentrating on going through, kind of going back through the wine list. And we started with champagne, which how could we help doing that? Because that's my favorite thing. And also it's kind of at the front of the list. And going through that and then not necessarily tasting older champagne with the waiters, but tasting older champagne at home. And also I recall having a very old champagne at Guy Savoy in Paris, quite a few years ago and absolutely hating it, and realizing that maybe I'm not an old champagne drinker, you know, that maybe I do like the freshness of a younger champagne. That was really an experience for me.
Yeah,
it was a learning experience.
That I've loved. I think maybe it's funny that on my list for wines for this year, two of them are champagne.
What are they?
But I think on my top 10 list of all time, I think I have three. If I were forced to make a top 10 list of wines I've had a chance to taste over the years, I think three of them are wines from Champagne, and not so young. You know, 1976 Ceylon is way high on the list.
And okay,
so Ceylon is a great, great wine that happens to be a sparkling wine from Champagne.
Right. And what does a 1976 Ceylon taste like?
The funny thing is, this is going to sound very hooey-gooey, I don't know. That, you know, when you're watching a movie and someone's trying to portray some sort of angelic being or something in a scene with other people, like the light is somehow different and they're there but they're not there, and there's a very particular presence to a mature Ceylon that is unlike other champagne that I have had a chance to taste. The only thing in the ballpark of it as far as presence is a bottling called Clos de Gouas from Philippe Onin, and that is not as consistently really well made. But Ceylon is all great Chardonnay from one particular area. The wine has, it seems like it's very light and seems like it's very clean, but it manages to leave no corner of your mouth that that isn't overwhelmed by it at the same time, you know? It's extremely pervasive in flavor. There's a mineral presence that is absolutely clear as a bell ringing in a cold morning, but it is not the dominant characteristic. You know, there is not a dominant characteristic of the wine aromatically or on the palate. It just that it is itself in both of those things. And there is, the aromatics are often neglected on champagne being interesting. And playing, if you're willing to play with champagne in different glasses, you begin to understand it a little better, what it actually means to understand the aromatics, because they deliver very different aromatics in different shaped glasses, and also when you pour them into your mouth, the different shapes pour it so that you actually taste it in different places in your mouth.
And you said that's
sort of in different order.
And that's all Chardonnay.
That's all Chardonnay.
And I have a question. So when champagne ages versus non-sparkling, and specifically Chardonnay ages, does it age differently as a sparkling wine? Does it change differently than it would if it were not?
Well, sure.
Sparkling.
The acidity is a little. The acidity is pretty high, first and foremost. That makes a difference as far as
in a champagne
keeping it fresh and keeping it slow evolving.
Okay.
One, the alcohol is relatively low compared to some, let's say, a bottle of Le Mans Rocher or a big California Chardonnay. The acid is much higher, and the alcohol is a good bit lower. There's a little residual sugar. Those are all factors that make it age more successfully, typically.
Okay.
Than a still Chardonnay.
Okay.
And the pressure that it's under is necessarily going to, you know, change its aging process as well.
That's what I'm and curious about.
It will very slowly lose some of that gas. Very slowly. But with a good seal on the cork, it will still very slowly lose a little bit of that gas.
Sure.
Having tasted a bunch of champagne back in the 50s, you know, those are still very interesting wines, and they still have effervescence, but not tremendously. If they've gone flat, then the wines also died typically.
Okay.
So it's kind of an interesting
Well,
thing.
And also the difference between champagne and a Chardonnay and a non-sparkling wine is that, as you say, it's been fortified. So the champagne has the sugar added to it, or it has a little bit of wine.
Maybe a tiny bit of spirit, but not fortified the way the Port Madeira.
No, but it does have a little bit of something added to it. So
yeah, exactly.
Maybe that makes... So with Ceylon, do they have their own vineyard sites, or do they buy from other people as well as have their own vineyard sites?
Well, Ceylon now is owned by Laurent Perrier, and Delamotte is the other label, so there's a connection there. But I mean, Delamotte is a very, very good producer, and so there are 10 parcels. Let's say there's 100% of the best Chardonnay that all comes from a Grand Cru site.
Mm-hmm.
That 1/10 of that is Salon. 90% of that goes into Delamont's Blanc de Blanc Vintage Brut in a given year, which is a great wine. It's nowhere near Salon's price. It's from the same site, but it still doesn't have anywhere near the presence that Salon does, and it doesn't age the same way.
Why does Salon set itself apart? How do they set themselves apart? Why is it so much better?
I think that they've just had a pretty maniacal quality approach for a long, long time.
Do you know how long they leave the wine on the lees?
I think it varies a little bit, usually 4 or 5 years.
So. Interesting.
The recipe has changed a little bit as time has gone along. That's the one thing I'm curious about is the ageability on wines from 1990 on. Because the older ones, the 76 or the 64, the 73, the 1961, great, and still very alive. I think 76 is top of the pyramid for me, though. The other things I was thinking about, by the way, for 16 was what's the best thing I got to taste out of barrel that wasn't finished yet?
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to sound silly, but the 2015 Beaujolais.
Oh, good. That's exciting.
A lot of those wines are either just bottled or just finishing when I tasted stuff in the spring. And man, oh, man.
Good.
A lot of the Cru Beaujolais are great. I mean, that's probably the best vintage there since 76.
Oh, that's good to know.
And,
good.
Some of the wines from
Chemin
Domaine de Pizou, the Boulogne, that are just remarkable. And the better Crus are going to age for a while. And
what was the last house?
Boulogne. Boulande. It's the devil to get that stuff, but it
ages
really, really well.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah,
okay.
And like Morgan and Regnier and a few other crew. But the Chemin, the nice thing about Chemin is that you can get those wines even just in a relatively regular Beaujolais Village bottling and have some of that. Some of those 15s are in the market now, so I would watch for those for sure. And then the other was like, what have I waited for to arrive? That I've been working at getting for a while, and those are the wines from Dottore in Sardinia.
Oh, good. That's exciting.
It's a long time between last visit and actually finally getting it through the supply chain. You see the label Dottore, Dettori, like our friend Mark Dottore.
Yeah.
Who pretends to be French but clearly a Sardinian. those are completely remarkable wines. As much as you love Châteauneuf du Pape, or anyone that loves Châteauneuf du Pape should taste those reds.
Well, the sad part about that trip,
that's all Cannonau,
is that I was super sick when you went to Dottore. I cannot believe I didn't get to go to that visit on that trip. That was an amazing trip. Sardinia is gorgeous.
Well,
beautiful place.
Dottore is great at what they do.
Yeah, I can't wait to taste that wine when it comes in.
Well, when we come back, we should have with us Robert Britton from Britton Vineyards, and who also makes wine for Winderly, and we'll see what in the heck else he's doing. But we can hear about his 2016 and then get into
fun.
A bit of a chef's challenge. All of that and more on The Former Wolf on Food & Wine. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And lucky for us, we have with us, fresh from yoga, so his voice will be much better than ours, Robert Britton from Britton Vineyards in Oregon, and also the winemaker Winderly, an excellent producer in the Willamette Valley. How are you this morning?
Excellent this morning. Thank you.
Hey, Robert. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me today.
So we're doing, this is our wrap of our favorite things from 2016. So why don't you give us your favorite things about this particular harvest? And if you want to give us your least favorite things about this particular harvest, as perfectionists, both of us understand that. But we want to understand 2016 in Oregon.
The whole thing about wine grape growing, and that's the term I really prefer to winemaking,
It really is 90% of it, right?
It at the level that I make wine and the types of wines that I've chosen to make for the rest of my career, I've been doing this for 43 years, and a big part of that, I started a very large company where it's all about blending and about the sameness of vintages. And I am in Oregon deliberately because the vintages are very different. I'm working with Pinot Noir very deliberately because it is so expressive, it can be so expressive of sight. And so with me, starting a harvest actually starts in January with pruning and with getting the and seeing what the vines had accomplished in their lives the previous year, and then getting them prepared for what I think is going to happen this year. And what happened was we had this very warm spring, more unexpected than not, and we had started out a very warm, early growing year. And on my site, where we're growing in volcanic, a lot of volcanic rock with very small amounts of soil, soil made up of the sediments from various volcanic events and ocean sediments. And but it's thin, and I have to be very, very careful with the amount of crop that I can handle because there just isn't enough moisture and fairly limited nutrients. So all of this has to be planned, you know, really well in advance. And then, of course, the vintage, which I so worship but still can so totally kick you in the ass, you know, comes along and does what it's going to do. And in this case, we had these cooling spells during the summer, so we were less, we weren't as warm, quite as warm as 15, but the vines never slowed down. They started early, and we finished early. And so we had a very early harvest, and that meant a very difficult harvest. It's kind of interesting. I'm talking to a lot of my fellow winemakers in Oregon, and they laud what a beautiful harvest it was because, as I said, we'd gotten a little bit of a cooling trend, and depending on where you were in terms of altitude and in terms of deepness, soil, and those kinds of things, you could sort of space your harvest out. Most of the properties that I work with for both Winderly and for Britain are properties that need a lot of focus. And so trying to make those harvest decisions, getting the crop just ripe enough without getting it too ripe, where these east winds come in that sort of drawing things out. We saw much higher alcohol potentials, and trying to pick those exact pick dates was very difficult. So the 16 harvest, I think the wines are going to be plush. They're going to be lush wines. They're going to be big wines like the 15s. But I think it was a much more concentrated harvest in a lot of ways, a much more demanding harvest, modifying the amount of work we did with the cap, with the grape skins in the tanks, trying to actually lessen the amount of phenolic extraction, those kinds of things to keep the lime wines a little bit lighter. It was a lot of pressure and a lot of thinking. So I think the 16 vintage is going to be another beautiful vintage, like 14 and 15, on the warm side. But I think it required a little more finesse on the part of the winemaker than, say, 15 did.
Hard to keep it from becoming a little ponderous, maybe.
A very good expression. Yes, I like that. Yes, to keep it from becoming ponderous. That's the problem that you struggle with alcohol potential. The wines become very, very rich, very ripe, and very full in the mouth. They become somewhat ponderous on the palate.
Since we're talking about this year specifically, what other recent years have you liked the wines, been pleasantly surprised maybe with their evolution, and other vintages that maybe in general you were less pleased with their evolution?
Mm-hmm. So I have struggled in the last few years as we've started to see some fairly significant impact of climate change in Oregon, and at least in the northern Willamette Valley. The ripe vintages, which, interestingly enough, of course, our consumer tends to really prefer, such as 12. I think the 12 vintages are a very good example of that vintage that is somewhat ponderous. And although it is a very full vintage, a very ripe vintage, it's actually somewhat short in terms of interest.
The 12s are a little chunky. They're not going to be the most elegant wines to age out.
They are not. They never will be. They're a little bit of a bully. The 13s, which, of course, was our abbreviated vintage in that we picked early because of a monsoon rain, the tail end of a monsoon that hit Oregon. The wines were picked at that sort of at that earliest point, but we'd had of ripeness But we'd had a very warm season up to that point. So the 13th, I find very interesting in that there are warm flavors, but there's a much more defined acidity to them, and they have this a structure that I know that that some critics have sort of canned, but I actually find them a little more compelling and probably going to age a little longer than, say, the 12s.
I like the bit of 13's firmness. I like a little bit of that, especially with food. Chef's question for you is always going to be the wines that you make.
Yeah, what do you like to eat with them?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with the wines where you have a bit more acidity to them, like the 13s, you actually have a broader range, a broader palate that you can make.
Of course.
That you can mix with or match to, there we go, food-wise.
Yeah, so when you think of Pinot and Burgundy, I mean, you think Burgundy is the one place where you grow beef in France, and mm-hmm. people often think, oh, well, Pinot, it's light enough for fish and all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, 100 years ago, people weren't thinking that. They were thinking, oh, we're in Burgundy. Give me some big log cutting Gervais Chambertin so I can have a Charolais, you know, steak in a pan cooked in beef fat. I mean, that's...
with a bunch of pepper.
It's going to have enough starch in the shorts to carry it off.
It is. And, you know, one of the things that I find really interesting, all wines, in my opinion, all wines have what technically we all, you know, and this is going back in my days in sensory science, where we talk about the secondary or perhaps the primary, as it were, flavors of the fruit itself. And we tend to get very, very focused on the fruit flavors. There's this whole much more compelling and much more interesting, I think, component to wine, which would be, as I say, you know, is technically herbaceous flavors, which is a term that we all associate with, you know, with Sauvignon Blanc and those green grassy characters, which there's way more to it than that. I've taken to calling these sets of flavors savory flavors, and because they actually, in the case of all wines, but particularly Pinot Noir, and particularly from certain sites in Oregon, and my site is one of those, where the Britton Vineyard is, more so than the Winderly site, where they you really get these sensations of dried herbs and earth, and this minerality thing that is so weird that really has nothing to do with the minerals in the soil, but has to do with the way the grape matures. Those characteristics can be very pronounced in some wines. And it's those things that I think make the wine much more interesting with certain dishes and certain foods than just the pure fruit flavors.
Absolutely. Otherwise, we'd all be drinking high C.
Yes, absolutely. So, only with a little more acid.
Robert, could you take maybe 2 minutes and give everybody a little bit of a recap of the wines that you do make and what they should be looking for in the marketplace?
Well, certainly. So let's talk about the Winderly wines first. So I work, it's a partnership. I do make wine for a few other clients. Bill and Donna, who own Winderly, are my absolute favorite people. Their vineyards, their estate vineyards, are biodynamic. And that, I think, is a term that I learned for biodynamic, which I really love, is this idea of intent. And it wasn't until actually I was doing some research on biodynamics that I realized that word has been a guiding directive for me in my winemaking for a long time. And Bill and Donna came to Oregon with a very definite intent. They bought a beautiful piece of vineyard in the Dundee Hills. And those wines tend to have a really expression of that red Dundee Hills fruit and redness in the soils. Just kind of comes through in the wines. But it's a warmer site, and it's made up of old vines and young vines. And the younger vines on rootstock make a very different wine because they ripen differently than the old vines, which are not on rootstock. And so these wines tend to be both the legacy, which is the oldest vines on the property, the estate wines, tend to be wines that are very, very much in the traditional Oregon style of red fruit and mixed with black fruits, and a really clear expression of fruit, with nice acidities.
Yeah, there's something about, of a giant Volnay Pommard cross with those wines.
You know, that's actually good. I'm glad you said cross. It drives me nuts to talk about comparison between Burgundy and Oregon. We've done it for so long now that it's a little bit like, well, actually, we don't really need to do that anymore, you know, because Oregon is Oregon, and I do believe the best New World Pinot Noirs are being made in Oregon these days, as is Chardonnay. If you haven't had Oregon Charge yet lately, that's a treat you need to dive into. But the Oregon wines are beginning to express themselves. I mean, we've been growing Pinot Noir. We've been growing Oregon in Pinot Noir in Oregon now for 50. In the northern Willamette Valley, for 50 years now, and we are beginning to understand that the different AVAs and the different places that we can grow Pinot Noir can give us much different expressions. And yes, I would put the Dundee Hills more in the Volnay or Pommard kind of character. The contrasting that out here in the McMinnville AVA, where my vineyard is, the wines are much more intense. They're darker. They generally have lower pHs, which means they have higher acidities. But not necessarily well connected. The chemistry in wine, where it comes to acid pH, is still fascinating. We still don't understand it completely. And it's the lower pH that gives you the mouthfeel, and particularly the longevity that wines can experience. And off of my vineyard, we have wines at much lower pHs, and much more acidity in the wines.
Now, I think it's remarkable that you have your hand in two very, very different sites making wines unique to the sites, and I think it's pretty cool to watch that your relationship through the year in each of those sites with how the wines are being grown ends up being reflected in the final products in the bottle. And I have to thank you for coming on this morning and taking some time and giving us an idea. And is there a website that folks should?
Yeah, you can definitely get an understanding of our site and all the different places we make, because I make unique wines from each part of the site here, and that would be BrittonVineyards.com.
We'll put that up on our website also, Robert.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thank you very
much.
Thank you.
Happy New Year, Robert.
All right, Happy New Year.
Thank you, man.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye-bye. It was cool to catch up with Robert.
Yes.
Folks should definitely go to the website and really and truly go out there, because he'll take all day and actually
explain. He's amazing.
That's everything, cool. Including the entire scientific history of Oregon Pinot Noir.
He's pretty brilliant. Obviously. That's awesome.
So here is our chef's challenge. Is a little bit different situation this time.
Okay. All right.
All right. So we're in one of the restaurants. We're taking inventory, right? And 35 people just walked in the front door.
Okay.
And they said they're there for lunch.
Good.
That they had made a reservation, and there's no one there but us.
You and I.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
All right. And so all we've got on the cooler. Mm-hmm. There's some golden beets that just showed up, chanterelle mushrooms, a whole sheet pan of chicken breasts on the bone. Mm-hmm. You're already stressing. The peewee potatoes, a bag of those, some fresh thyme, all the dairy and cheese, lemons, all that sort of foolishness. There's plenty of wine in the cellar. But they're obviously hungry. So how do we get this done quickly?
Well, it's easy.
What's the longest thing to deal with?
The beets, actually. The potatoes. You only said potatoes.
Yeah, but the peewees. That you're talking about like a 10-minute cook time.
No, I said the beets.
The beets.
The beets are the longest cook time.
Beets are the chicken
breast. Did you say baby golden beets?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's not too bad. I say we boil them, because roasting takes forever. So we could just boil them in a little bit of vinegar, sugar, and water.
You want to get the grill hot and season up your chicken breasts?
Yeah, you handle the chicken, and I'll do the beets. And, I can make some. Well, we could either do the potatoes with the chicken. You grill the chicken with the thyme, and then we add
you
the beets.
You want to slice potatoes in half and grill the potatoes as well?
Yeah. What are we doing a first course?
You want to blanch them first? No, I think we just
okay.
have to feed these people.
Oh, well, that's fine then.
We have to feed these people.
So right. So the golden beets on the plate.
I already gave them four bottles of rosé. I think they'd be done with that in a minute. Then they're going to start to tear stuff off the walls.
All right. So we'll just marinate the chicken and the thyme and the extra virgin olive oil, maybe a little salt and pepper and some
lemon peel.
Yeah, sounds good. And then grill those babies and have some pickled beets, basically, on the plate.
It's
going to
take a little bit longer just because it's on the bone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, it'll take 10 minutes, 9, 10 minutes, 8, 9, 10, depending on how big they are. And then just, boil the potatoes in their jackets in heavily salted water.
Thinking about the details of this nightmare, I'm like, are people just wandering around the restaurant?
Do we have to
think
about
that part?
How do we
get the table set up for them? Oh, my God.
All right. Well, I can make the food and you can handle the front of the house.
Well, I can tell them what they have to do.
Yeah.
You know me, I'll just like holler out of the kitchen.
You don't have to help me. But you don't have to help me, but since this is a chef's challenge.
No, I'll get the chicken breast done. You do the rest.
All right. Yeah. So you have pickled beets and beautiful mushrooms and a little cream sauce. I can make a little cream sauce with the mushrooms as well. We could chop them fine.
35 people. Someone's going to have a dairy problem. You know this.
Oh, well, that person gets the mushrooms and extra virgin olive oil on their plate with a little bit of your fresh lemon and thyme in it.
Why don't a roast of chanterelles and make a little extra virgin olive oil like a
why don't
vinaigrette
you?
With the juice? Oh, my God. We have control problems.
Really?
This is the 35
do
people,
you think?
what they're going to get for lunch is a fight.
Oh, boy. No, we would do it. We would do it fine, and it would be mm-hmm. tasty. What wine are we drinking with chicken with chanterelle mushrooms and cream sauce and pickled beets? Let's just not pickle the beets because that'll throw off your wine. That'll throw off your wine. We'll just boil the beets.
Don't pickle the beets.
And toss them a little bit of good stuff. Well,
you can make a salad from those guys. You have
well, that's why I said, but you didn't give me any lettuce.
No, you don't need lettuce.
To make a salad.
If you're an Italian, you don't need lettuce to make a salad. Come on.
No, you don't need lettuce to make a salad, but...
All right. So, no, you could just slice those beets nice and thin. Maybe if there's a little Stilton or a milder blue in the cooler or something
Oh,
like
now
that.
There's secret stuff in the cooler that we didn't know about?
I said all the cheese. Look. All right. So give me one.
Cheese.
Jeez.
Anyway. All right. Anyway.
All right. What do you look forward to eating in 2017?
I really would like to work more with some of the with more offal. I'd love to be able to find lamb sweetbreads somewhere that are excellent. I would really like to, do rabbit with the kidneys on the plate and do something with the beautiful livers that come from the fresh rabbits and things. I'd like to do a little
rabbit
bit.
Rabbit livers make such good mousse.
Lovely. Oof. Yeah. So I'd really like to work a little bit more with some of the things that are a little bit more obscure that people don't always think about nowadays. So, but lamb sweetbreads are really kind of my goal. I want to find some beautiful lamb sweetbreads.
Good.
How about you?
Biggest thing for me, I want to make more things with these amazing goats that we're getting.
Yeah, that's fun.
I want to make and eat more things with these goats that we're getting.
I love Chivito. Yeah. Very nice. Chivo.
Well, that's all we have time for on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. Please, if you want to listen to this or any of other broadcasts, please go to the WYPR website, WYPR.org, and look for the Foreman & Wolf page. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media.
On Instagram, it's Chef Wolf. On Twitter, it's Chef Cindy Wolf.
On Instagram, I am the real Tony Foreman. And if you want to email us any comments, questions, requirements, it's foremanwolf@WYPR.org. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Thanks for listening.
And Happy New Year.